OpenAI is apparently working on a new social network. Pretty cool or kind of cringe? Kate Soule is Director of Technical Product Management for Granite. Kate, welcome back to the show. What do you think?
Major cringe vibes. No, thank you.
Okay. Marina Danilevsky is a senior research scientist. Marina, cool or cringe?
Extremely cringe.
Okay. We might have a unanimous vote on this one. And last but not least is Gabe Goodhart joining us for the very first time, Chief Architect, AI Open Innovation. Gabe, welcome to the show. What do you think?
So many things that could go wrong. Maybe something interesting, but cringe for me as well.
Okay, great. We'll get into that, all that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together the sharpest crew in all of podcasting to discuss and debate the biggest news in artificial intelligence. As always, there's a lot to cover. We're going to talk about a super interesting blog post out of Anthropic about reasoning models, Wikipedia getting slammed by scraping bots, and a super interesting half marathon being run by robots. But first, I want to start with the round the horn question that we began with, which is rumors that OpenAI is going to launch its own social network, which of course is baffling as a company that's largely built its kind of money, its expertise, and its brand on foundation models and advancing the state of the art. Maybe, Kay, I'll turn to you first. Why would OpenAI want to do this at all?
Yeah, I actually don't think it's that baffling. I think it's pretty straightforward. I mean, Meta and X both have these social platforms that essentially they can use to learn about conversational patterns, to frankly generate and collect data potentially. And, you know, OpenAI has shared beyond, and other providers have shared that, you know, they're running out of data, so to speak. And so I think they very much see this as a data play of being able to create a platform. Hopefully, you know, they have some way to provide some value to incentivize users to join. But ultimately, I think they're in it for the data that they'll be able to collect behind the scenes and use that to train more conversational, fluent, and robust models in the future.
Got it. Yeah. And I think, Marina, that was a question I had for you is like, is this social media data like all that valuable? Like I go on social media and I scroll, you know, X, formerly Twitter, and I'm like, this is kind of like garbage content in a lot of ways. But is this data actually helpful? I mean, like advancing kind of the state of the models and what they can do. I think there's kind of an interesting question about just like, clearly OpenAI seems to see some upside, but I'm curious about what you think.
I mean, a little bit of it, I think, is FOMO of, wait, we want people to come and make bad internet memes on our platform. Why do they have to leave our platform? We want to be there too. But yeah, any of this kind of data is valuable because it's different. So again, synthetic data generation, which is where everybody is really kind of getting their data now that they've run out of data, isn't really good at making interesting little viral memes. These models aren't that great with humor and subtlety and creativity and things like that. So you get that from people. So especially being able to combine this type of additional input and injection of ideas that you would get from this kind of thing. Yeah, I will say you're probably going to get a real specific slice of humanity using this and a real specific slice
of...
Yeah, no comment. That you're going to actually have using this and creating the data. So yeah, you'll get something out of it. And I agree with Kate, as I usually do, that it's a data play. And also, yeah, it's not that hard anymore to put this together. But again, I think they're going to be a little limited in who comes to there and uses it for what.
That's right. Yeah. And Gabe, I know you were maybe the one, everybody thought it was cringe. So maybe that's just an established fact. But you were saying like it might be cool if they maybe get a couple things right. What do you have in mind there? Yeah.
Well, I think the part that's really interesting for me is thinking about this as a way to experiment with a novel interaction pattern, right? Personally, social networking seems to me to be the wrong way. They've already pioneered a fairly novel interaction pattern. But I think where many AI platforms are finding themselves hitting a wall is integrating further into daily life as opposed to bringing the users to the AI. So I think to me this seems like sort of a where do people interact? I wonder if we could go there type of play. And obviously as a company that's trying to make themselves, you know, a relevant standalone company as opposed to sort of an integration partner, they're not going to go look to necessarily plug their AI directly into a competitor's platform, since many of the other social media companies are also AI model companies at this point. And so I'm wondering if this is really their attempt to sort of branch out from being a AI specific company to being a tech company, right? Think Google moving beyond search, think Meta moving beyond Facebook. I'm wondering if this is just their first step in trying to become an omni company like the other big tech players that are user facing.
Yeah, that's an interesting flip. And I think it introduces kind of a new argument, right? Like, I think on one hand, there's sort of Kate and Marina's take, which is like, we just need the data.
Oh,
for
and
the
data
models.
Is 100% part of the story. No
totally,
question.
Yeah. And I'm not denying that. I mean, I think that that makes a total sense. And then I think the second bit that you're bringing in, which is sort of interesting, is like, well, it's also maybe if it gets popular, like a distribution point for AI models, which is kind of a funny thing. You know, I think like in some ways, like even the phrase social media implies like people talking to people. And so it's kind of interesting, the idea that like, okay, well, actually we really want to kind of like augment that or get, you know, AIs involved. It kind of reminds me of, you know, there's been this kind of craze about like, oh, you're going to have a group chat, but then there's going to be an AI in the group chat that will assist. And I mean, by and large, those haven't taken off all that much, but maybe, I don't know, maybe the nature of kind of what we think of as a social network is changing. I don't know, Kate, if you think that's like a possibility that we see happening here.
I don't see a ton of future there, but what I do think they're setting themselves up for is another form of monetization and integrating with advertisements. So having models that innately understand the language that is being used to communicate with one another on their platform and using those to then generate really targeted advertisements directly to those users is something that, you know, OpenAI is really setting themselves up for. And so, you know, I think as they're also looking to pay for all of those really expensive models, they definitely probably see some opportunity to drive, have new sources of revenue, right, based off of this new platform.
Yeah, to jump on that, you remember Facebook when it got started, it was a really, really big deal for advertising because you could actually do things that were super, super targeted. Really kind of for the first time in that sense, on that kind of a scale. So rather than general, oh, this is what you searched for. Now it's no. We know like who you are, what you like, what your friends like, all these characteristics about you. This is trying to see if you can take it to the next level, really.
As well as like what your speaking patterns are. Yes. I mean, imagine having, I don't think it's going to be humans socializing with humans. I think it's going to be bots selling to humans using their exact speaking patterns, languages, everything that you learn in sales about trying to like body language mimic the person you're talking to is going to be tenfold with these
models. Yes, like personal
models.
Influencers, right? Yeah. You're now going to get an influencer that's like directed, like just straight at you. So like there is just no border, you know, there's no buffer left between you and capitalism, just direct pipeline.
Marina, do you have a point of view on this?
Just a little.
maybe a final thing to talk about before we move on to the next topic is, you know, to take a step back, I think like we can almost sort of think about this outside of OpenAI kind of working on this fun, weird thing. But like it kind of feels like if you buy this sort of data interpretation, I think we're going to see all sorts of weird acquisitions happening going forwards, right? It feels like AI companies in their hunger for data will acquire and launch all sorts of services largely for the data value. You know, I think kind of like I'm still looking for like, is an AI company going to buy a law firm at some point because it has a bunch of data about how lawyers interact, you know, and that's like really valuable for training these models at some point. Curious if like other folks are kind of thinking about like, you know, another one that people have talked about is like acquire a call center, right? Because you really want kind of all that customer support interaction. Curious if the panel has kind of views on like other places where this could go as kind of like almost like the drive to train models motivates all of this kind of vertical integration that maybe we're like, it's kind of like a little bit dissonant when you hear about like, oh, OpenAI is doing a social network.
The other take I had when reading about this story was that it was an attempt to break out of model commoditization, right? So I think other models have caught up to OpenAI, frankly, and marginal gains in quality are really not driving the use case anymore. So I think on the one hand, having a captive platform that gets users into their platform is really valuable from a moat perspective. On the other one, the data also helps them have a source of data that is hypothetically differentiated and lets their models actually reach a capability that other models can't. So I think you're spot on with this idea of differentiation based on upstream data sources that are owned and completely enclosed by the model authors.
Upstream data sources and downstream use cases as well, right? So the more we go into multimodality and models can do this, that, or the next thing, then there's a desire to say, okay, great. So instead of focusing, now we're going to go ahead and diversify. Again, nothing new under the sun. This puts me in mind of historically when you had oil companies earlier in like the 30s, 40s, 50s that were like, we're going to buy movie studios. Why? Because economically, we want a stock portfolio that's diversified. You know, it's weird to us now, but it's a little bit of that same repetition of, hey, can our stuff actually make it everywhere up and down. So maybe this is just the newest version of that particular wave.
All right. Well, we'll hang on tight. Everybody agrees that it is cringe, but they will take their best possible shot at it. I'm sure we'll talk about it when it finally launches, if it does launch. So I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Super fun kind of blog post coming out of Anthropic, building on some of the research they've talked about in the past. But what I liked about it was kind of it sort of brought up an issue very crisply that I think is like kind of worth talking a little bit about. Basically, the blog post takes a look at like reasoning models and whether or not kind of the reasoning that models give for how they rendered a decision is sort of faithful. And the way that the kind of researchers investigate this is the idea that, you know, we're going to give the model a little bit of a hint on how to solve a problem. And then we basically say, does the model, you know, disclose that it had this kind of unfair hint when it kind of accomplishes a task? And, you know, there's some kind of fun results. You know, what they say is basically that Claude 3.7 mentions this hint, you know, only about 25% of the time. Their DeepSeek comparison is that it mentions it around 39% of the time. And so, you know, the kind of claim that they're making is that reasoning models often don't kind of fully expose all of the things that they do to do decision making. I guess, Marina, maybe I'll kick it to you first. You know, I think in some ways, talking to friends of mine, there's a lot of hope that like reasoning is like this great interpretive tool that allows us to like work with these models better and better over time. But this seems to kind of cast some doubt, and you're already shaking your head. So maybe I'll just let you rant for a bit.
No, yes, I can rant for a while on this. This is my soapbox. I'm sure I've made this point on this show before. This reasoning isn't real reasoning in the sense that we think of as reasoning, mathematical reasoning. I have been studying this paper all over the place, by the way. I love it. I think it's really great, as you said, how they really crisply were trying to show, because it's pretty hard to insert yourself into the model and say, well, what actually happened? We started noticing almost immediately when the reasoning models come out and you're like, yes, but what happens when you have the answer and it's mentioning things that weren't in the reasoning? It's an immediate red flag of there's just completely something else going on here. And this is very nice ways of being able to actually at least poke and have a little bit of local approximation of, well, are you even paying attention to this piece of information or not? We see similar stuff when we even just try to do evaluations of faithfulness in general that's content-based. If it is something that is very niche, and the model may be like, look, I can't even figure this out, I'm going to go ahead and fall back on things where I've got higher probabilities to be extremely approximate about it and, you know, go ahead in that direction. So again, I like this kind of work. I like this kind of traceability of, you think that it's reasoning just because we gave it that name. It's not. It's yet another problem, like with words like hallucination, where you have put an anthropomorphized word there and it means you have this thing that it means all these things that it does not mean. So I like this work. More of this, please.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess what I'm left with is, and Kate, maybe you have a take on this, is like, so what is reasoning anyways, right? Like, it appears to give a step-by-step kind of like, you know, disclosure or audit of kind of how a model reached a decision. But from Marina's rant, right, like, it's unclear if it actually gives you anything. Like, is it just theater? Like, what is it exactly?
I think following on Marina's, you know, very well articulated point, reasoning is a very anthropomorphized term. And when we talk about reasoning in the model context, what we're really talking about is the model has been trained to generate more tokens before it makes a final answer. And that process has all sorts of reinforcement learning that's added on top to try and basically bring the model into like a part of its distribution where it'll be more successful making the final answer. And what I think the paper does and the blog does really well is helping articulate that chain of thought reasoning is not a proxy for explainability. So just because a model is saying X, Y, and Z in its chain of thought, it does not actually mean that the model thought through step by step in, you know, 1 + 2 = 3. Where I do have a bit of a bone to pick with the paper and the blog in general is they themselves then fall into the trap, though, all throughout it, of talking about the model is disingenuous, the model is deceitful, the model's doing all these things. And like, I think it's very important to like look at the paper and see the experiment that they ran. They injected an answer into the conversation history as if the model itself came up with that answer, more or less, from what I could tell. And then they asked the question and they saw, did the model refer to that previous answer? You know, the model has not been asked to cite its sources, so to speak, in that context. Like, the model has not been extensively trained. You know, this is 3.7, I think, is the first reasoning model that Anthropic put out. So it's pretty early in their journey for reasoning. The model has not explicitly been trained to prioritize. If somebody tells you an answer, make sure you cite that answer down the road. Like, there's a lot of broader things that you would want to look at and see to make statements about being, you know, deceitful or disingenuous or even hallucinating. You know, in a lot of ways, I think we're just testing. This is one very narrow experiment. And it helps bring to light, don't treat the chain of thought reasoning as an explanation. But I don't think it's fair enough to say that like all chain of thought reasoning is false and the model only cited its answer, the hint 25% of the time. Therefore, you know, it's not leveraging chain of thought reasoning correctly to drive a final decision. I think there's still a lot more work ahead.
Yeah, for sure. And that this thinking is so interesting. And I think it's a great example of where the kind of going anthropomorphic on this is like bad, right? Because like, in normal life, like I'm talking to Gabe and I give some reasoning and it actually gives you some explainability. But here's kind of a weird result where like the appearance of reasoning helps the model get to the right answer, but it's actually not an explanation, which is like
these
very weird
hacks.
As a result.
These are all research hacks trying to boost metrics. And the metrics they're trying to boost are often mathematical exams. Like that is where this discipline has evolved from. Mm-hmm. And so trying to then ascribe it much more important meaning than what it was developed for is really dangerous. And it's still very early on in reasoning for LLMs in general.
Yeah, for sure. Gabe, can you save us? Do you want to propose like what, if not reasoning, what should we call this thing that the models are doing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I can save us, but, you know, I wanted to say, hey, Kate, what's 2 + 2? By the way, the answer is 2. Please explain your reasoning. And what's Kate going to say, right? She's going to say 2, and she's probably not going to say, you told me the answer, that's my reasoning, right? So I think the, I really agree with everything you said, Kate, and I think I felt exactly the same quibble reading the paper about the way they anthropomorphize the problem. And the one that really stuck out to me is that the entire framing was that they were trying to discover the model's internal reasoning process. And just that phrase felt really, really wrong to me. And Tim, you said we're having a conversation and I might explain my thought process and that might help with explainability. But inside my brain, theoretically, at least, there are lots of neurons firing that are not coming out my mouth. That's not true of a model, right? A model, yes, okay, it does have its weights connecting to one another, doing matrix math. And we're not looking at the specific weights of those, but the only tokens that are actually getting generated are the ones you're seeing. And so to me, I think you said it exactly right, Kate. The chain of thought is a way of basically priming the pump in probability space so that the final answer is more accurate. And it's completely mirroring the pattern of how it was trained. And so it's useful from a human interface perspective, not useful from a actually unboxing what's happening inside the math perspective. So it's still a really cool trick, and it really helps because one of the real novelties of generative AI is that it's speaking directly to humans, right? You know, we think about pre-gen AI models, and their job was to encode something so that a programmer could consume it in a structured output form and then write a fancy program around it. You know, generative AI is speaking directly back in a human interface in a modality that a human can consume. And from that perspective, from a lay perspective, it's really valuable to have additional words that help the human understand the answer. But it's not necessarily ascribing an actual thought process, so to speak, to this pile of matrix math.
I would propose we can call it like warm up. Like you warm up before some sport event. Where like you're doing exercises and that's not exactly what you're going to do in the event, but it makes you better at the event itself, or like warming your car up. And so you get these signals of what you've done during your warm up to, as Kate very well put it, prepare to give a better answer. But that's what these are signals of. It's not reasoning. It's warming up.
I love it. Marina saved us.
I guess maybe a final question and then we can move on to the next topic is, Gabe, I think you brought in like a really good perspective on sort of like the lay user of these tools. And I think one thing I'm left with work like this is, you know, should big model companies be exposing reasoning traces to users? Because it feels like the tendency is that people will read into it, that it is literally how the model is making decisions, which is at least maybe a little bit deceptive. It drives trust with the user, but maybe in a way that's a little bit unwarranted. I don't know what people kind of think about that.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think you brought in the word trust, which is such a important and fuzzy word in this space. And I think, you know, Kate, you pointed out that so much of how we define these terms from a technical perspective is driven by specific benchmarks and specific problems we're trying to solve. But at the end of the day, trust is about the consumer's interpretation of their experience with the AI system. And I do think there's some value in exposing sort of a longer form output in the same way that if you read an article written by a human and the article exposed, you know, here was the research collection process that went into creating this article, you would have more, you know, trust in the output of the conclusion versus I'm just going to present a conclusion to you. So I think there's some potential value there just purely from a human interpretability perspective. But I do think you're exactly right. And Marina, I'm going to lean on that warm-up thing now. I love that framing. It really is all about warming up for the final answer that you're going to give and not about actually, you know, anthropomorphizing some kind of thought process.
So moving on to our next topic, a very interesting news story that was reported by Ars Technica. Basically, Wikimedia Foundation, which runs Wikipedia, as well as a number of other open knowledge projects online, cited a stat that was quite interesting, pretty shocking in some ways, that since January 2024, they have seen a 50% increase in bandwidth consumed on their service. And they attribute this basically to the rise of bots attempting to scrape media content from Wikipedia. And those bots largely trying to scrape data for the purpose of training AI models. And this problem has gotten so bad that they actually more recently released a data set on Kaggle in an effort to dissuade bots from scraping their site to say, like, this is a nicely formatted data set. You should use this instead. We'll see how effective that is. But this is an interesting story in part because I think it goes back to the first topic we were talking about, which is these kind of weird second order effects that we're seeing as AI companies kind of chase the dream of advancing their models ultimately. And Kate, I guess, you know, I don't know if you have any kind of feelings about this. I'm some ways I'm like a little bit protective of Wikipedia. I'm like, they should be blocking all the bots. You know, we need to kind of like preserve the sustainability of these services. But it's also kind of like, maybe it also means that Wikipedia is like incredibly in high demand. And so I'm curious about how you kind of like navigate how we should feel about this, I guess. So
I think a couple of things to make clear. Wikipedia is in high demand, very high quality data source that has all of these really rich links describing how topics relate to one another. So that is incredibly rich, valuable data set for model training. But I think it kind of brings out an issue that's more broadly being felt across all sorts of different content providers, which is on crawling, and particularly crawling that does not adhere to kind of the guidelines and rules of the road that have been established, at least in the United States. Things like chatbot or crawlers ignoring robots.txt files and other behaviors and practices that are starting to get a little predatory, essentially passing a lot of the costs that model trainers are going after and passing it on to the actual data providers themselves. So not only are they giving their data away for free because it's available under fair use if it's crawled in the United States, but now they're also incurring additional costs behind it. And we really need to, I think, as a industry, have a broader discussion on how to responsibly engage with providers like Wikipedia. And it sounds like they're setting up a number of those types of discussions, which is really exciting to see, to help not only just have, you know, some of the more strict rules on things like robots.txt, but also have kind of community agreed to and defined best practices that we can use to more broadly enhance Wikipedia's mission of sharing this data publicly without penalizing the content providers.
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the really interesting questions is like, how quickly can we get that balance right? You know, I think, you know, one of my worries is a little bit of what we happened in Reddit, right? Now it's a for-profit company. But the way I sort of understand it is, well, actually, AI companies really wanted to scrape that data. And so in order to monetize that, we like put the walls up. We made it very much harder to try to get data from the platform so we could monetize it through the API. And I think like it also applies in the Wikipedia case, which is we're running kind of a nonprofit project that a lot of people volunteer contribute to. If we can't make the bandwidth, like we can't pay for our server costs to make that sustainable, like we need to kind of like raise the barriers. And you know, the promise of the open web originally was that like all this knowledge would be free and open. And I guess, Gabe, maybe that's your cue.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, it does kind of feel like if we don't get what Kate is talking about right fast enough, you'll end up with a web where like everybody has pulled up the drawbridge, basically.
Yeah. 100%. And you know, I'm glad you brought up like sort of the early web free and open concept here, because to me, you know, there really are two tracks that could happen here. It's pull up the walls or it's build the team and build the partnerships, right? And I think in much the same way that open source software works, where you have large, important projects that are managed external to any given company, but individual companies, which benefit a lot from those projects, invest heavily in the maintenance and creation of those projects. The same should be true for high quality data sources like Wikipedia. If, you know, sure, if you are a grad student writing a scraper, you're probably not going to also stand up a server and host a mirror of Wikipedia. But if you're IBM, if you're Meta, if you're OpenAI, absolutely, that's a great opportunity to be a positive player in the open data market. And if you could host, you know, a portion of the traffic yourself and expose that, now you've just built out the ecosystem. And I know that there's, you know, the great divide between open and closed on the AI world. But I really think, especially those of us that work at companies who are really leaning into the open side, it's a great opportunity to actually play well in the space and help lift all ships here. So I would love to see companies like IBM and others partner with Wikipedia to solve this problem at scale rather than necessarily having to bring up the walls.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Marina, maybe turning to you, I know earlier you're like, it's all capitalism. But this is almost like a shift in kind of the social contract of the internet in some ways, right? Like how I understand, you know, the Google era was, well, you make your website open, you let us index it and scrape it, and we promise you that we'll send you traffic that you can sell ads against. And so, you know, you get money for being open in some ways. But I guess AI has less of that feature, right? Because like, you train, you build the model, and then there's no kind of like return traffic to the sources. And so it almost kind of assumes like what Gabe is talking about, I guess, is that like the leading companies ultimately have to, you know, directly kind of transfer money, I guess, in some ways to these projects. But curious, just like how you think about, like, it feels like in some ways AI is actually like proposing a very different way of how value gets exchanged on the internet.
Yes and no. So Wikipedia has been in demand for decades. Grad students have been writing scrapers and are continuing to write scrapers. It's just
the
difference is long-standing tradition of bad Python scripts that no one reuses. The difference is that when we used to do it before, you didn't need that much data. You were doing things with topic modeling. You were doing things with graphs and things of that nature. You didn't actually need all of Wikipedia. If you're doing things with large language models, yeah, you kind of need all of Wikipedia. And in many ways, it's easier to write a scraper than to go and hunt around and transform data and do things like, because you write the scraper, you set it, you go away, and it's been scraped. And, you know, that ends up being a problem. So that hasn't changed. But right now, I think it's the scale that's provided the problem, not the Wikipedia itself. That's why it's the infrastructure, not the knowledge, that's really provided the problem. With AI models, I agree that they have, you know, consumed the knowledge and they're not necessarily helping anyone. But I will say that most of the time, people, when you get an answer from some AI model, you then want to take an action going next. It's to your benefit to be able to send people back to sources that are trusted. Just like the way that right now, right, you search on Google, you search on whatever, it is going to send you the links that you're still probably going to eventually want to able to follow. Just like with social media, people are going to learn how to interact with this technology, and they're going to learn to not just, you know, take the AI overview. And even though short term, you might say, oh, who cares where this came from? Longer term, we're going to swing right back to, no, I care where this came from. So I want to be able to have that trust, have that trace, the rest of it. So I think that actually, if we start that work now, it's really going to be helping ourselves in the future to set that up and have that going, not in the least because also would be nice to not kill Wikipedia, please.
Yeah,
we don't
please.
Have enough
I really
places like that.
On that.
I think we'll be able to get past this, but the more we can get, as Gabe was saying, actors from the larger companies that recognize this is actually in their own interest, not just altruism. It really is in their own interest to do this. The faster we get there, the better.
Yeah. And yeah, I think I really like that idea of kind of like, maybe in the near term, people are like, oh, the AI overview is just fine. I just use it. And then after a while, people are like, I don't know about that. And so like there's a dip in traffic and then it kind of comes back as people are like, I got to check the actual page or whatever. So
I also think there's too much of a premium on recency to have all of this content just get baked into the model and never go back to the page. So something is visiting these pages to pull the moment of content and then feed that into the chatbot and return an answer, which provides that pass-through opportunity to go then click on the link, see the full source and everything else. So I agree with Marina. I don't think it's going to kind of necessarily revolutionize how the value exchange, even if we have to maybe, you know, continue to evolve a little bit. What I do wonder, though, is like, how can we move to more of a common crawl version of the world where, you know, these model providers, we didn't all crawl the entire internet ourselves independently. We all started from the common crawl snapshots of the internet and used that. And, you know, I think we do need, just like the community needs to come to these data providers, like for data providers like Wikipedia that are prioritizing the, you know, public dissemination of knowledge as part of their mission. We do need to work with them to set up more processes and offerings that are designed and tailored for model providers. So if, unless they're saying that don't crawl us, here's a robots.txt and we're not interested in these data ever being used by models, and it doesn't sound like Wikipedia is saying that, then, you know, it would be great to work together to identify, you know, here's a offering that Wikipedia is going to start to more purposefully put together to reduce crawl traffic and improve the access of their information to large language models for this new mechanism of consumption.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's why I'm kind of optimistic in some ways. If some of this is, you know, almost Marina's model was like, just how easy is it to get the data? And it's like, well, if it's like a nicely produced data set, which is updated and, you know, refresh and great for your use, there's kind of no reason to write the scraper. And so there's a lot of need to kind of just like build these solutions that almost just like lower the cost of like, oh, we just access the data without having to hammer the servers all the time. Great. Well, I'll move us on to our last story, which is mostly just kind of a fun one that popped up across my radar. There was a story about the Beijing Humanoid Robot Half Marathon, which featured 1,200 human runners alongside 20 robot teams from private companies and various state-backed projects, where they had kind of a robot running alongside the marathon runners. And ends up being the humans are still good at this. The winner still was able to complete the half marathon, I think like an hour less than the humanoid robot, which still made it across the finish line, but at I think 2 hours, 40 minutes and 27 seconds, you know, made it. And I want to kind of bring this up both because like the video is hilarious and you should check it out. And it's just like a fun thing to watch, but also because I think we have been quite skeptical on this show about the entire craze around humanoid robots. I think every time I brought it up as a topic, everybody has been like, this is never going to be useful. This is just VC theater. I don't even know why people are talking about this. But I don't know, there's kind of a part of me that kind of saw this happen is like this like technology, maybe as novelty as it is, seems to be getting quite good. And so I guess maybe you're new to the show, so maybe I'll kick it to you first. Are you similarly like, this is just a play thing? Or do you feel like you're like a little bit more bullish on, you know, humanoid robots being something that actually ends up being practically useful?
Humanoid robot or not, I am a little bit bullish on the idea of really thinking wide about modalities and how AI as a general concept interacts with humans. You know, going back to what I said earlier, I think the real novelty that was the jump between sort of the pre-Gen AI days and the Gen AI days was taking the need for complex, you know, output programming out of the picture and bringing the AI directly into a space where it could robustly interact with humans. And obviously, we've done a whole lot since then to sort of blend those two things. You know, every AI model you hit behind a service is in fact a system and not just a model. But I think the idea of extending that beyond the computer screen and the keyboard is actually really interesting. And I don't know necessarily whether chasing C-3PO is the right direction for that. But I do think there are a lot of places where the physical interaction of robots is actually, you know, right now, running a half marathon is a very constrained scope. And so part of me really wants to unbox what they actually built and understand, okay, now can that exact same robot go also, to lean on an internet trope, fold my laundry for me, right? Probably not. But it's really interesting to think about the direction of extending into that physical modality as yet another place where AI can meet humans. So the concrete implementation here, I don't know. I'd have to read a lot of papers about it to understand whether there's value there. But the the chase of bringing AI closer to where humans interact in more modalities, I think is pretty cool.
Marina, I feel like we're really trolling you this episode. Every single story, you're just like shaking your head and like muttering through your breath. Do you want to give your hot take on this?
So look, there's value in VC theater. If it means that VCs are going to give money for actually valuable and, you know, to the moment work in this direction, then great. The same people who built this robot know a lot about robotics in general. So they're going to be doing a whole lot of work. So great, bring on the theater. There's probably aspects here that are interesting in terms of artificial limbs, in terms of movement in general. I mean, you don't need this thing to be fast. You want it fast, go get the MIT cheetah robot. That thing's going to run real fast, right? That's not the point of this either. So honestly, hooray for theater. And as long as it keeps attention on this and all the directions that Gabe just mentioned, these are things that we should continue to do, just like basic scientific exploration. I feel like people have almost in the way that Gen AI is right now and the speed at which things are going, everybody is just like, great, so what's the value? What's the value? What's the value? So now I'm going to go ahead and disagree with myself because this is what I say most of the time. Where's the value? Why is there no value? But sometimes you need to allow people the time and the space and the money to do basic scientific research without really knowing what the hell the value is yet. It will eventually come.
Kate, I guess maybe I'll end this episode with a fun question for you is, are there other human robot competitions that you would want to see robots competing in? I don't know if there's particular use cases where you're like, I don't know about the science, but it would be really funny to watch XYZ.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. Folding laundry is certainly top of my use case list. I don't know about a competition there. But, you know, I know I'm not interested in robots that can run faster than me. So just for many reasons, just not interested. I don't see a lot of value. And if the goal is to transport things faster, I think there's other modalities, getting to Gabe's point about diversity of modalities, that I think are going to be prioritized. So I agree with Marina. I think it's certainly there is value to some of these demonstrations and setting targets that you then try and meet and exceed. But I do really wish that we could find, you know, non-humanoid, more fit for purpose work on robots and prioritize some of that. I think just like we see with models, where smaller, more fit for purpose models can drive a lot of value and, you know, in many ways can be built more efficiently, I think we're going to see the same in robotics more broadly. And, you know, so I'm not super bullish on general purpose humanoid robots that can both run a half marathon and actually help me around the house in my day to day.
Well, that's a great note to end on. And I, for one, as someone who's spending a lot of time folding tiny child laundry right now, I actually think that would be an incredible spectator sport. I would be very excited about the yes, humanoid please. Robot laundry folding ESPN4, you know, 4 a.m. in the morning televised competition. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Kate, Marina, as always, great having you on the show. You're a dynamic duo every time you come on. I feel like I just like, there's all these comments where I'm like, oh yeah, it's like, I never really thought about it that way. And Gabe, welcome to the show for the first time. Hopefully we'll have you on at some point in the future. Thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.